Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I've developed a new travel habit. While I'm packing for a trip to somewhere new to me, I make sure to look for historical podcasts about that place. A lot seem to be made by historians, both professional and amateur, who know lots of stories about a place and find them all too interesting not to share. And some are also made by public radio stations, too. One of those shows I found recently is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. Each Tripod episode is its own micro-documentary devoted to a single story or subject from New Orleans history, like its tourism trends, how a secret basketball game helped desegregate school sports teams, architecture and barbershop politics, and more. It's all leading up to the city's tricentennial in 2018. Tripod is also a collaboration between the public radio station WWNO and an advisory group comprised of historians, archivists, and other experts based at several historical centers and organizations in the city. In this episode of Tripod, we'll travel to New Orleans' Treme to hear how one particular stretch of interstate reshaped a whole neighborhood and simultaneously gained one nasty nickname.
This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson. Part one of this story was about the proposed Riverfront Expressway through the French Quarter and along the Mississippi River. That leg of the highway did not happen, and the French Quarter was saved from being demolished under a freeway. But that same year, 1968, a different section of the Riverfront Expressway did go up. What was under that part? The Treme neighborhood. More specifically, Claiborne Avenue.
Oak trees lined the neutral ground, businesses and homes, churches. So it was like a real neighborhood.
This is Dodie Smith Simmons, a local civil rights activist. We're walking along Claiborne today with the freeway overhead, which is why it's kind of loud.
This is the oyster house, Lavada's, that had the best oysters in the city. My classmates and I would put in and buy a loaf and divide it between four or five people. And you still had a nice sandwich.
And now what is it?
A parking lot. A lot of places are gone.
To make the highway happen, the state had to acquire 155 individual properties along Claiborne between Tulane Avenue and St. Bernard Avenue. The state also cleared over 200 oak trees. In 1950, there were 123 businesses in this section, and almost 50 years later, just 44. One business that still does stand after a post-Katrina comeback is the Circle Food Store. Dodie grew up in the 9th Ward, but like people all over New Orleans, her family still came to the Treme to make groceries.
Anything you needed, you could find at the Circle Food Store. Vendors would come in and sell their produce, their livestock, chickens and turtles and whatever. And I have not been in the Circle Food Store since it has reopened.
You want to go in?
Yes. Wow. It didn't look like this back then. Oh, this is wonderful.
Do you want to walk around a little?
Yes.
Being in Circle Food reminded Dodie of the other major reason her family came to this part of town.
Back in the old days, Zulu and the Indians were not a part of Mardi Gras, a white Mardi Gras, I should say. It was a part of Black Mardi Gras. And Black Mardi Gras happened on Claiborne Street. We did not go to Canal Street.
Or St. Charles Avenue, or pretty much anywhere else white people were celebrating. The freeway overhead was called the Bridge. Others called it the Monster.
So when the bridge went up, did this Black Mardi Gras that you're talking about stop on Claiborne?
It wasn't the same. It wasn't the same. Like all of the overhead noise we heard, you heard back then. Yeah.
Nice, huh?
Yeah, right on time. And
As Dodie started to describe, Claiborne was home to the longest single strand of oak trees in the country. It was also known for its azalea bushes and a neutral ground so wide people played football, baseball, all the sports. It was a grand avenue and a place of pride and belonging for the black population, especially at a time when they weren't welcome in the neighboring French Quarter unless they were on the job. Dodie says it's hard to imagine an area of the city that was more significant to the black community.
There were people protesting the bridge being built in this neighborhood, but it was just a minority. This is white versus black, black versus white. And in the South, if you're black, you're not gonna win. So this was something white folks want. That's what they got.
You're listening to Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
I was a young man at that time, and we were just shocked.
This is Louis Charbonnet, sitting around a table at Dookie Chase Restaurant in the Treme with Lambert Boissier and Edgar Chase III, a.k.a. Lil Dookie. His parents, Leah and Dookie Jr., still run the business. Speaking of businesses, Louis and Lambert both owned funeral homes on Claiborne. Here's Lambert.
We had a funeral home on Dumaine in Claiborne, but my brother's over at Charbonnet now. We're family competitors and in-laws, so...
So it's a family affair here.
Wow.
I mean, not sure we're not kin otherwise.
Lambert's funeral home closed some years after the interstate went up due to a fire. Charbonnet Labatt Funeral Home is still up and running.
Well, we've been in business since 1883. We're the 10th oldest African-American funeral home in the country, and we survived that because we were half a block off of Claiborne.
These guys ran businesses along flower shops, insurance companies,
coffee houses, hardware stores, drug stores. It was just any kind of business you could imagine was on Claiborne Avenue. I mean, on a Sunday afternoon, this is the place to be.
I'm Dookie, and I'd like to add the fact that there were a lot of benevolent associations there, societies that helped people pay for things that they couldn't afford.
Inseparable friends, Juniper Tez, Jean Zamin. Used to be all those little society places that gave you money when you went to the hospital. The neighborhood fed on each other.
Louis says what was a mecca of black-owned businesses was all of a sudden scattered around the city.
When you uproot something, it's hard to plant it someplace else and for it to survive.
So there were all these business owners and a strong, supportive community. So why couldn't the project be stopped?
We tried to organize some opposition to it, but it just wasn't enough.
It fell on deaf ears, Louis says. There were only two or three black people in local government, and without that representation...
You got stuck with what came your way. The interstate became a reality because of the haves and have-nots, and the have-nots got stuck with the interstate.
Within the system, there was essentially no one in government to defend the black community and communicate the cultural and economic necessity of keeping Claiborne intact. And outside the system, those who were active political organizers were busy with more pressing things.
It wasn't something that New Orleans Corps, maybe the NAACP too, we're not focusing on this.
How come?
Well, because we're focusing on the five and dime store, their restaurants. Then it was the Freedom Ride.
Yep, that's Dodie casually mentioning her being slightly preoccupied with the Freedom Ride. Dodie was a member of the local chapter of the NAACP and then CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. In the mid-60s, they were working to end segregation, for the right to walk into any restaurant they wanted, go to any school they wanted, and feel safe no matter where they stood. Here's Lewis.
To worry about trees and flowers and grass was not our main interest at the time, but we were worried about what was going to happen to our children, to us.
He says by the time they realized how bad the interstate would be for the neighborhood, it was too late. This caused the black community to organize in a new way. It made them say,
this will never happen to us again. And as a result, we've gotten blacks elected to positions that can represent the part of the city they live in.
Like Lewis, who was elected a city rep in 1970, and Lambert, who was elected to city council in 81, then went to state senate in 99, and finally the constable's office in 2001, where he still is now.
Institutional racism is a factor that we have to face in the United States of America.
That's Dookie.
People don't know that they're making decisions based upon race. It's unconscious that they are, but the power that they have tends to favor those who look like them. Mm-hmm. Power doesn't flow to those who really need it, but it flows to those who are a certain color, who already have the power.
The idea of removing the interstate has been discussed since it went up and regained traction again after Hurricane Katrina. Some people, including many Mardi Gras Indians and Dodi, don't think removing the interstate will bring back what once was and may even further gentrification throughout the Treme. But others dream of seeing the day it comes down.
It was a hot subject at the time. It's going to be a hot subject continuously until that thing comes down.
When we're both around, all three of us are around 2026, we'll be driving down the Claiborne Avenue.
Historic,
yes, historic, with the tree lines, the flowers, the azalea bushes. It would be our glorious 2 miles. Huh?
Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music. Catch Tripod on the air Thursdays during Morning Edition and again on Mondays during All Things Considered. You can listen to Tripod anytime, anywhere by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. You can also go to WWNO.org, where you can see Claiborne before the interstate in all its oak and azalea glory. Tripod's also on Instagram and Twitter. If you don't know, now you know, @TripodNola. Hit us up. Also, big thanks to Emma Long for research and production assistance this week. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
And I'm Emma Long, and I'll Tripod you later.
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. A favorite way radio stories and podcasts can reel me into a particular history is through music. There's so much about a place and a time that can be discovered when you take a deep listen into the music that was around then, or even by diving into the story of one particular band, and sometimes even one particular song. The podcast Van Sounds is produced by one person, Phil Corbett, who tells stories about movement gathered from around the world with a lot of music thrown in for good measure. It's a great show to listen to when you're in a high state of wanderlust. It can take you into punk houses, introduce you to rappers in rural Nevada, and, like in this episode, give you a look at subversive rock under a military dictatorship. Quick note, at the start of the story, there's a reference to drug use and a particular side effect of said drug, which might sound squirmy to some listeners. Here's Phil.
You're listening to Van Sounds. I'm Phil Corbett. I puked neatly into the crimson toilet. Lima, Peru, 3 a.m., middle of summer, sweating, waiting for a flight to Argentina. I had laid awake in this hostel before, a scrappy cement lobby lit by a bubbling empty fish tank, the room hot. Framed photographs of farm animals sloppily photoshopped into scenic landscapes. Bars on every window. Peyote, or South America's psychedelic equivalent, ayahuasca, makes you throw up. A cleansing, some people claim. You expel the bad and let yourself slide into a cleaner state of mind. You empty yourself out. This bathroom floor was a purgatory, purging myself of home, and I soon found my feet on new ground, Buenos Aires. In this case, there. There. The news magazine Slate has a web series called If It Happened There. The US media tends to use a drastically different tone when covering international news. So this series points that out by using the same tone on U.S. news. Most recently, on the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the headline, the unexpected death of a hardline conservative jurist on America's constitutional court has exposed deep fissures within the ruling regime and threatens to throw the country's fragile political system into months of chaos. In our normal tone, America and its problems are somehow separate from the world's problems.
I think the problems are the same problems. Each country have his own.
This is Hugo Latorre.
My name is Hugo Latorre.
He owns the Singing Rooster Record Shop just off the main strip in Buenos Aires. He specializes in collector's records and specifically Argentine national rock.
In the beginning, the rock music was an answer to the militaries here who took the government.
National rock, or rock nacional, is a huge genre in Argentina. And to be honest, when hearing about it for the first time, I was expecting British or American-style stadium rock, sung in Spanish. But each person I talked to seemed to be prepared for that assumption. They'd immediately claim it's unlike rock from anywhere else. And sure enough, it is. One band that kept coming up was this band, Serú Girán, a band headed by South America rock legend Charlie Garcia. The band's entire existence, four studio albums, were released during the military dictatorship in Argentina, which took place from 1976 to
1983.
It's an unexpected blend of progressive rock, stadium anthem, and in a lot of the songs, Latin and South American folk rhythms, all punctuated by powerful revolutionary lyrics.
My book is called Rock de Acá, is Rock from Here.
This is Ezequiel Abalos, the author of Rock de Acá, or as you heard him translate, Rock from Here.
And that book was interviews to the musicians that was the pioneers here of what we call national rock, and that songs became like hymns against the repression.
If you didn't catch that, he said hymns against the repression.
They don't copy the rock that became from outside. They do a new kind of style with the spirit of the rock. Argentina is one of the countries that have a lot of communities from all parts of the world.
And with that immigrant culture comes a rich diversity of sound. But an important point is that it's not just the influence of new rhythms that differentiated national rock. It was the political climate, too.
I think that the military government was one of the differences. It was very difficult to play music talking about the things that they passed.
Well, my name is Nicolás Perry, and I am from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
In Buenos Aires, I stayed with my friend Lou, who you heard way back in the Inca Trail episode. And one night, I hung out at the house and played a Spanish language version of the game Risk with her brother and this guy, Perry.
Right now, well, I just got a Red Hot Chili Peppers revival. Like, I've started listening them again.
as we killed each other's little plastic armies, colonizing each other's cardboard territories. We talked politics.
To think it couldn't happen there is stupid. It could. It kind of has.
You had blacklists, you had police departments arresting students, you had fire hoses, you have the NSA.
The state here also hid behind the whole anti-communist thing.
We drank and argued.
That was something that the dictatorship tried to do here in Argentina. If you were able to express any feeling in words or in music or whatever and get to another individual and make that individual feel the same thing, you are a revolutionary. You were something that wanted to destroy everything good that the state and, in this case, the government, the military government, were trying to do in order to keep the society together.
In 1982, the military dictatorship, known colloquially as El Proceso, declared war on the United Kingdom. In the 1800s, England colonized the Falkland Islands off the Argentine coast, and in a move of basically posturing, the dictatorship wanted the islands back. They rolled some dice, moved a bunch of plastic pieces over the board, and England won. This, along with a bunch of other dysfunction, simplistically put, fractured El Proceso's public approval, and democracy was restored in 1983.
Before every single revolution, because what we mostly hear about revolutions is that there are some revolutionary people that lead the people all together in order to change the system in some sort of way. But what's never told about these stories about history is that underlying all of this, there's a process in which individuals start to see others as one of their own. Not in a tribal way, but in a human way, in a way that they can say, hey, dude, I'm the same like you. It needs to come from the people. It cannot go the other way around. I mean, it was not the Beatles that created rock music. There was people that were expecting for the Beatles to appear.
That lyrics were very important for us in that moment.
This is Ezekiel, Rock De Acá author again.
We saw in that moment that there are other people that think like us.
Most people I talked to credited National Rock with some of the distrust that led to the regime's fall.
I think and my central point here is the most difficult part is people to listen and care.
On my last day in the city, I went to the Military Dictatorship Museum with a handful of strangers. It was dedicated to the thousands of people, mostly artists, activists, and writers, that simply disappeared during the night.
The censorship didn't work as perhaps in America with the blacklists and stuff. I think it worked here in a different way. If you had a radio program and started playing songs that the government didn't like, well, it was not that you were going to get out of your radio program. The thing is that you were probably going to be kidnapped and killed. So it worked in an implicit way. No one wanted to risk their life to play a rock and roll song on the radio. The dictatorship in Argentina was worse in the sense that people were killed. But leaving that aside, I think that the spirit is actually the same.
I think the problems are the same problems.
It's to censor any kind of cultural activity or expression that rebels against the system.
Outside of the museum, I talked to an old woman. To really get national rock, she said, you had to experience it. I'm glad you didn't, but if you did, she trailed off. It's like standing outside of a concert hall. It's 3 a.m., you're sweaty, the lyrics are still in your head, and they're singing about a world without fear. A place without violence and murder and repression. It seemed like a far-off world, somewhere over there. Somewhere else. Not here. Sounds is produced by me, Phil Corbin. You can find the show on iTunes, Twitter, Facebook, PRX, and at our minimal website, vansounds.org. If you like the show, be sure to rate it on iTunes or to repost it wherever. Thanks for listening.
Camiones llenos y a pie me tengo que ir. Diario llego tarde y la puerta me han de cerrar. Te muelen en tu casa que la tarea has de llevar.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look for The Spot under the Programs tab. Is there a podcast you've just discovered and can't wait to share? Tell me about it. Email me at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.
Te muelen en tu casa que la tarea hace llevar.